Om Agyanatimi Randhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuru Nilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
Interesting statement here, which might seem to be axiomatic, but it's not something that we would normally think about unless it's drawn to our attention. The statement from the translation is that by curbing dishonest miscreants, one automatically benefits the offenseless. So, persons who are offenseless, they might not feel the benefit of the dishonest miscreants being curbed. But if the dishonest miscreants are not curbed, then the offenseless persons have to live with the offenses of the offensive. So the king, who is the representative of the Supreme Lord, he cuts down the miscreants with anywhere within the state. If there's any discrepancy in any part of the state, the king is responsible. Yesterday we were discussing Varnashram and Srila Prabhupada's desire and mandate for his followers to establish Varnashram. We were discussing some of the many difficulties in doing so. We were discussing some of the difficulties in establishing farm communities. But we were talking about a king, that we were talking about a whole state or So it's not just a matter of setting up a few small farm communities, which for us is a very big task, but actually, as Srila Prabhupada wrote, changing whole nations to Krishna consciousness. And it's particularly difficult to do so in the modern world because states, even though superficially independent, are actually not. Now, one devotee who's preaching in Sri Lanka, I think a few of you know him, Vasudev Datta, he's from Europe. he was manning a book table at a major temple event. That means it was a Murugan temple, Subramanya temple, some temple in Sri Lanka, when some big politician came. And the big politician came to the book table, and so Vasudev spoke to him and said that as a leader of the people, you should institute policies that will, according to Shastra, according to Dharma, that will actually benefit the people. And he said, yeah, we'd like to do so, but there are bigger forces than us. Even outside this country, he said, a little country like Sri Lanka might be apparently independent, but they're controlled by bigger powers. They have to think of India right next to them, and actually they're more under the sway of China. They have to be under someone. Little country like Bangladesh, where I spent several years of this lifetime, there's another example that there were some anti-Hindu riots or in one area of Bangladesh, and then it just started just one day or 2 days, and a big minister flew in, which they didn't used to do much in those days in Bangladesh because fuel's expensive and there aren't that many helicopters. So he flew in and he addressed a big rally and said, look, you're the majority, speaking to the Muslims, but just remember there's a country next to us with 800 million Hindus, so just stop this, he told them. So, having a king. Now, it's mind-boggling what Srila Prabhupada wanted us to do. It's beyond our imagination. Well, it's not now because Srila Prabhupada put it into our imagination. Otherwise, we couldn't have imagined this. Otherwise, Srila Prabhupada couldn't. We couldn't imagine this if Srila Prabhupada hadn't given this idea. And actually, in many ways it sounds very good, although monarchy or dictatorial rule is discredited throughout much of the world. Definitely in the Western world. In the Western world, dictatorial rule is so much considered wrong that it is considered a justification to invade a country and topple its government because it's dictatorial, as in the case of Saddam Hussein, of recent fame or infamy. But in the Islamic world, that's which, for all us here in the West might think that we are the best and we've got it all worked out, but the Islamic world does, by the way, constitute a large percentage of the world's population and a large area of the world, and in terms of natural resources, especially oil, an important part of the world, as I suspect that Western intervention in the affairs of Afghanistan and Iraq and Kuwait, not only on humanitarian grounds. I have some suspicion. Of course, in Afghanistan, it's not oil, it's poppies. And it's a geopolitically central place, has been since the Westerners got over there. No one's ever been able to conquer it. The British failed, and the Russians failed, and the Americans failed. And their history is, it's not really a country anyway, it's just a bunch of tribes fighting with each other, and they'll probably go on doing that forever. And if anyone else wants to enter into the scene, they'll fight with them also. So, so the idea of having, in Islam, it's central to Islam that there has to be a king, or the word may not be exactly the same word, but that is required, and which automatically discounts all ideas of democracy. And that has become a major divisive point in Islamic society, just like in Egypt at the present time. There are the Muslim Brotherhoods wants to establish Islam according to the scriptures. And the present government is against that to the extent that they want to kill all the members of the Muslim Brotherhoods, 600 plus, who they've arrested. So at least in the Western world, the idea of a king is very much anathema. Up until recently in India, it was very much part of the culture. Although that's changing now, and people, because the two generations have grown up with what they call democracy. But in Rajasthan, this Gayatri Devi, who's the Maharani, she's the Jaipur ruling family. So when she stood for election, every time she just massive vote, because everyone thought, well, obviously, even though she's a woman and it's supposed to be a Maharaj, not a Maharani, but in the absence of the Maharaj, Maharani's better than some upstart. That was the consciousness. And the tendency to love the king also. That was there. That's still there in Thailand, which is also getting a lot of politics in this class. But I guess if you talk about kings, then politics has to be there. In Thailand, all the people love the king. It's just part of being a Thai. They all love him and they think that he really cares for them, which he probably does, but although he's not able to do much for them. In many ways, he's like a very ordinary person. He's very old now. I also lived in Thailand for some time. Yeah, and in Thailand, in every house, in every office, you'll see a picture of the king and the queen. And in Muslim countries also, you'll see the sultan. It must be a new part of the culture because photography is fairly new. It didn't come up until started in the 19th century, I believe, late 19th century. But that's just, even in the Hindu homes, no. They might do, they may or may not. But in public places where others come, just like where there's a gathering of Hindus, they'll keep a picture of the king. Not the sultana, which means the wife. Maybe because there are too many of them to have so many photos. But, in Islam, they're not supposed to have more than four wives at a time. And also under the influence of Western civilization, it's in the Islamic world, it's mostly becoming one man, one wife also. The influence of the Western world is very widespread. In India, they also made it that Hindus can only have one wife, although it's not Hindu culture. And it's still some people have more than one wife, but it's becoming rare. They have different laws for Muslims. Muslims are allowed to have more than one wife. Funny thing. So the whole concept of a king, that was prior to... When shall we say? When I guess with there was the whole Enlightenment, and then Martin Luther turned against the church, which was unthinkable. How you could go against the authority of the church? But still, for many years, the authority of kings was considered. Inconceivable. How can you have any system of government without a king? It was just natural in every society all over the world at various levels of sophistication. There has to be a king. In some places there were queens also, but it was unusual. The people in India during the reign of Queen Victoria, they were just amazed. How can a woman be so powerful as to have such a big empire? It seemed to be very, but the concept of having a king, and even with the Enlightenment and the rejection, gradual rejection, punctuated by some major spikes. Darwinism was a major spike against. Anyway, it's a complex history which I don't know all of, but it wasn't that Charles Darwin was deliberately going against religion. But there's gradually been a breakdown in trust in authority and in kings, and which has brought us to democracy. And I believe it was Winston Churchill who said that democracy is a terrible system of governance, but it's the best that we have. But it seems, the description that Srila Prabhupada gives here of kings, wouldn't it be better to have a good, honest king? Who took responsibility and kept things in order, rather than having, just now, if there's something goes wrong, who do you complain to? What are you going to do? Someone who's mistreated, especially if they're mistreated by someone in a higher position, they can't be confident that they'll get justice. To get justice, you have to have money in the court. And those who have money, they'll prevail in the court. That's stated in the Bhagavatam, 12th canto. What's that in the Sanskrit? Nyaya rahitam. I can't remember. That those who have money will have justice. It's a sarcastic statement. The term justice means all. The term justice means what those who have power define it to be. That's the same. Knowledge also. History. What is history? History is what people in power want you to believe about what happens in the world. Everything. It's just a mess, to put it simply. So the idea of a king is natural in human society, but it has become unnatural. And in fact, democracy is an admittance that everyone's corrupt, or a lack of faith that anyone is competent to lead us. And so you elect someone for a short time. If he's actually fit to be a leader, then put him in and leave him in. Well, you have the option to do so. Democracy in India is, although it's advertised as being a celebration of the effectiveness of democracy, that it came to a country with no history of such a thing and it adjusted to it, and it's the world's largest democracy. But everyone knows that sometimes the politicians in India, they used to say that I'm doing this as a seva. The word seva is translated in English as service, but in English the word service gives the idea, well, you're doing some service, but you might take some money from it. But the word seva means service that is done as a duty, dharma, within dharma, and you don't expect to get anything back. You just do it because you're obliged to do it. So the politicians used to say that, well, I'm just doing this as a seva for the people. And for the, no one ever believed them, so they stopped saying it. And it's well known that to get a seat in parliament, and of course there are lower levels also within the governmental structure, to get a seat in parliament you have to spend a lot of money. There's no way. And then, there are lower levels, state level, and then district level, and taluka level, and this and that. So, but if you do get in, then you make money. And there was a survey done of the last Lok Sabha, which is the equivalent of the House of Commons in England, if you know anything about that. I guess that's similar to Congress in America. Yeah, lower house, yeah. That the average politician after 5 years in office as an MLA, that's like a congressman, similar to being a congressman, their average net worth financially, I mean, that's what they declare, it had increased 265 times. Yes. And there are questions as to how Sonia Gandhi is a double billionaire when she was the wife of an airline pilot, and she says it comes from the royalties on her writing her books. So so democracy, yeah. Democracy, supposed to be a better system, but it fosters corruption. At least if there's one king and who's corrupt, it's better than having 500 or so sitting in parliament and they're all corrupt. And the system of kingship allows the king, not only allows him, but says that he should live opulently, should have a big, should have riches. To generate the riches, he has to make the country rich. And his riches, they are for him to show he's a representative of God. And also, that's a buffer against times of poverty in the state. In times of poverty, then the king, he has to arrange for, in times of famine, he has to arrange for food to be imported, and he'll pay for it in jewels and gold and something of that's considered of actual value. So, is it a good system? Well, any system can only be as good as the people within it. If you, whatever system you have, if the people are if they are devoid of the four principles of dharma, namely mercy, truthfulness, cleanliness, and austerity, then whatever system you have, it's going to be disastrous. There's no system that can function very well. But if the leader himself is devoid of these symptoms, then there's no hope for the state. There's a saying in Bengali that Raja Nashta Praja Nashta. If the king is spoiled, then all the people are also spoiled. That's similar to the Yad Yad Acharati Shrestha verse of Bhagavad Gita, which that the people follow the example of the leader, and Krishna exemplifies that with the by citing Janak Maharaj, ideal king. It's interesting that Srila Prabhupada wrote these purports in the early 1960s. And at that time, if we read this now about corrupt leaders, anyone who's not totally brainwashed, which means at least some percent of people who are intelligent and somewhat thoughtful, there are many people nowadays who see that politicians are just completely corrupt and they're spoiling the world in so many ways. But up until maybe Nixon was the watershed in America, up to then, I would think that the people generally believed that the leaders had the interest of the country and the people at heart. And probably they did. Although without proper training or information about what actually constitutes the good for the people. We see here that Srila Prabhupada talks about the duty of the king is to curb the dishonest miscreants. But generally, it was presumed that the leaders, they actually had the interest of the country and the people at heart. But then it came up with Tricky Dicky, which was the standard nickname for him. Tricky Dicky, Richard Nixon. It wasn't just the Watergate break-in. As Srila Prabhupada noted, Srila Prabhupada said, well, what do you expect? That's the kind of thing, talking about Watergate, Srila Prabhupada said, well, that's the kind of thing politicians do. Srila Prabhupada didn't seem to think it was such a big thing. But there were other things which came out about him later, just like, there were tapes of him in which someone had presented to him some scheme for medical insurance, and he said, "Yeah, I'm not much in favor of all these medical schemes for the people." And the person saying it to him, no, this is not being done for the benefit of the people. This is being done purely as a business venture." And he said, "Oh, well, that's okay." And a rascal, rascal. Just the idea that a few should benefit at the expense of the many. That is exactly the reason that we need a king, to curb such people who want to take power to exploit the people. The king is supposed to stop such people, but when such a person becomes a king, then it's Kali Yuga. What is that? In Bhagavatam also says, Prajas Bhakshashishanti Mlecha Rajan Rupina, that in Kali Yuga, mlechas, the lowest class, worst kind of people. Actually, the original meaning of the word mlecha is someone who doesn't speak Sanskrit, by the way. They will take the position of kings, and their business will be to devour the citizens. They take power, and then they just exploit the citizens. Again, speaking in a, coming to present day politics, is it the power of Maya that politicians don't see this, politicians in the West don't see this, or is it some, they're deliberately effing things up, sorry. Their actions in going into countries in the Middle East and undertaking military adventures that have resulted in the loss of over a million lives in Iraq. Do they not think that this is going to create enmity that will last for generations? Maybe the Islamic world had just about got over the Crusades, and now this, and it doesn't make any sense. America, just by the very nature of time, is that sometimes some nation comes up powerful and then it goes down. America's been up, it's going down. So they might think that by force we can crush these people. Our oil is under their soil, so we should go and get it. But the long-term effect is, it's got to be disastrous, creating enmity. So, even though they must be very intelligent people to get the post of, to get such high posts, and no doubt the leaders of these countries, they're surrounded by very intelligent people, but they're really Maya Paritha Gyana. They're intelligent, but they're knowledgeable. They can write reviews and this, but their intelligence is taken away by the illusory potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, yeah, as we were discussing yesterday, establishing Varnashram, it seems, how is it going to be possible? It's only going to be possible by the mercy of Krishna, but we have to do our part also. Just like spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world is only possible by the mercy of Krishna, but someone had to reach out for that mercy. That was Srila Prabhupada. He went out and he gave himself fully, with full faith that ours is not to reason why, ours is but to do and die. He was, I may succeed, I may not succeed, but anyway I have to do what I'm ordered for spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world. Many times Srila Prabhupada said that I'm, especially in his early times in America, before things started to flourish, he said, there's one 1966 lecture in which Srila Prabhupada says, he was talking about Vrindavan, and he said, that's a very nice place. Actually, I'm not happy here. And do you remember hearing this? And a woman present says, yes, I can see that. He said, I'd like to be in Vrindavan, but then why am I here? Because he was talking about duty. And to illustrate it, he gave the example of himself. He said, I'm here because my guru ordered me. So I have to do my duty. So because Srila Prabhupada was willing to fully give himself, then Krishna clearly wanted to give the mercy to the people of the world, and Srila Prabhupada became the fitting medium by which that mercy could be transmitted. This Varnashram establishment, it seems impossible. Srila Prabhupada said 50% of my work is not done because this isn't done. And it seems impossible. We have to remember that spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world was impossible. It became possible by the total surrender, commitment, and faith of Srila Prabhupada. Even though when Srila Prabhupada first went to America, for many months, it seemed that he could have died at any time, and there would be nothing. And his going to America would have been what was the word one that Mongol Maharaj wrote to him? Something ludicrous. Prabhupada was writing to one disciple of one of his godbrothers, and who wrote to him that your endeavor might seem ludicrous. And Prabhupada wrote and said, it may seem ludicrous, but I have to do it. And it might have seemed that what so many people said to him before, why do you want to leave Vrindavan in your old age? You go to the West and then you die in the West and stay in Vrindavan. You can go back to Godhead. What do you want to leave Vrindavan for in old age? So it might have seemed that they were right. Srila Prabhupada was tested by Krishna in that way. It's not that Srila Prabhupada rolled into America and everyone started bowing down to him and said, Shishyaste hang shadi mang tuang prapannam. They had no idea of what it meant to be a disciple. No idea. And that's still one of the many prominent differences between India and the West, is that in India, even though there's still a culture of gurus, and even though most of them are just rank cheaters, but people, it's within the culture, people know what it means to have a guru. In the West, they have no idea. I mean, the word guru has entered, but the cultural understanding of what it means to have a guru has not entered at all. The understanding or the connotation of the word guru, that as it's used in the English language, I suspect that it's overlaid with ideas of some slick, sophisticated person who talks something which sounds good and slips your money in his back pocket. So this Varnashram, Srila Prabhupada wanted to first of all establish a class of brahmanas, people who are fully fixed in spiritual consciousness, fully disciplined. Discipline is very much central to Vedic culture. With the breakdown of authority all over the world, it means that this society can't stand. America's doomed. A decadent society is doomed. A society that has no inbuilt respect for authority, it can't stand. America can dominate by technology, but if the American and British soldiers had to face man by man, or nowadays it may be woman also. That's another thing. Why do you want to send women out to fight? This is a horrible idea. Anyway, if they had to fight man by man with the Afghani tribals with the same kind of weapons they had, they'd be... I think one Afghani could finish off 10 or 20 Americans by himself. But because they have the technology, they can just go up in a helicopter out of the range of the Afghani tribals' weapons and just pick them off. And it's as Prince Harry said, I was good at doing that because I grew up playing computer games. So it's just like a computer game. They're sitting in a helicopter and they pick up some Afghani tribals who they think might be what they call terrorists, who are just some people living in the mountains trying to get enough food for their families, and then they do the patriotic thing of killing them. This society can't stand, even if it's not overcome. Even in the short history of the world that is accepted as actual history, in our ignorant modern civilization, which thinks that the human race and human civilization, what's the latest? When I was a kid at school, I think it was about 3,000 years there'd been civilization. They're gradually pushing it back and back. How many years is it now? Any idea? What do they teach in schools nowadays? Civilization began with the Greeks. So, even in the last 3,000 years, we've seen there have been so many civilizations, and they all, what happens is they, by being rough and tough and nasty and mean and aggressive, they conquered other people, they became dominant, and then they became accustomed to luxury, they became soft, and then other people who are rough, tough, nasty, mean and aggressive overcame them. That's what happens. So America has the advantage of being... America's greatest defense force is the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. And Britain also. That little English channel has saved them since 1066. But otherwise, this society couldn't stand. And even if it could stand, what is the use? What is the use of a society that is simply based on getting more gizmos and computer games and no real culture? Culture means to understand what is the actual purpose of life and to act on that basis, which is another reason. Oh, now something clicked in my mind or my brain or whatever. There's this idea of Krishna West has been floated. You're probably all familiar with that, in which the idea is that let's just keep the essence of the philosophy and we can adjust the culture to Western culture, which I'm not wholly against that. Mostly devotees who meet me think I must be wholly against it because I have to fly the fundamentalist flag. But I'm not wholly against it because anyway it's going on and it has to go on. We see that everywhere where there's preaching you have to make some adjustments to the local culture. And we're all doing it right now, by the way. For instance, wearing socks. That's just a very small indication of how we're not fully Vedic. And there may be so many temples serve pizza prasadam and wearing the jackets like, for instance, Rajendra Nandan Prabhu is wearing. Yeah, it's already incorporating elements of Western culture. So I'm not wholly against that. And obviously, preaching means to make communication with people at some level and to bring them from that point to the point that we want to bring them to for their benefit. Same thing with this question about bridge preaching. All preaching is bridge preaching, but it just depends how long you want to make the bridge. How long you want to make the bridge, and then, and the point is not to stay on the bridge or to cross over to the other side, but to bring people over to this side. So I'm not wholly against the idea of Krishna West, but there is a severe problem in thinking that we can run Krishna consciousness on a template that is meant for sense gratification. Because Krishna consciousness runs on the template of giving up sense gratification. Ultimately, we have to move toward that. And of course, in the Western world, it's not in the past history of the Western world, it's not been one of total sense gratification. For instance, the much maligned Puritans, who were also, at least Oliver Cromwell killed the king, which was considered, it was just, there's even a term for that, regicide, king killing. That was considered something, it's just, how can you do that? Okay, be a Puritan and and stop people from celebrating Christmas because it's not in the Bible and it's not conducive for being good Christian, according to the Puritans. But what do you want to kill the king for, even though he's corrupt and he's a jerk? But you can't kill him. But they did. He was killed. And it was a major reason why people lost faith in Oliver Cromwell. So it's not that traditionally the West has been a culture of sense indulgence, but at the present time it certainly is. And also there are certain, just like this concept of having a king, it really goes against what Western civilization stands for at the present time. The idea that, what is that? We take it as self-evident that all human beings are equal. Isn't it? What is it? I'm not from America, so I don't know. You must know, because you had to learn it recently to become an American citizen. They're all created equal. Well, that gives the idea of God. Maybe the atheists want to change that. Created equal by God, yeah. But I think they didn't include blacks at that time. They weren't humans. They didn't include women either, yeah. Women in the Christian... women didn't have souls until several years of Christianity. There's only one certain pope granted them souls. I don't know what happened to all the other ones before that. Maybe he gave them a retrospective... maybe by the grace. I mean, Christianity really has a lot of theological problems. A lot. I mean, the whole thing is... I mean, Jesus being God and... Anyway, let's not get into that. Listen. But the present... To the extent that it is considered fully justifiable to enter a country which far away from you, that's no threat to you, and invade it and topple the government because it's run by a dictator, a king. It's considered fully justifiable to establish democracy. And that's the purported reason. Of course, Saudi Arabia also has a king, and there's no sign of America invading Saudi Arabia. Latin America, yeah. Where? With this Paraguay? In Chile, they had an elected leader who was overthrown by the CIA because he was communist, and they put in a dictator who was the most anti-human rights person in modern history. Pinochet, I think his name. Yeah, there are many historical facts about this. So, how are you going to convince people if they think, well, one culture, our... Well, that's actually a principle of Krishna West, that actually the modern Western culture is the most advanced. That's bogus. I mean, that's completely bogus. That's why I often said that Hitler was better than George Bush. Because when Hitler wanted to invade other countries, he said, look, we're Germans, we're jerks, we're bastards, and we're invading you because we want to take over your country. And when George Bush wants to invade, he said, humanitarianism, democracy. Just be honest, you know, we're just jerks. And we're invading your country. So in that way, he was better. So, the first George Bush. I don't know. So, this idea that Western culture is the best, then you've got to deal with all these anomalies of Western culture. They talk high things and they go on doing the same bad things that they use as justifications for carrying out their policies. Oh, there was something recently. It was so ridiculous that there was a Russian TV channel in America, and the newscaster, after finishing her newscast, said, "I'm resigning here online because It's totally unjustifiable that one country militarily intervene in another country without any right. She's talking about Russia entering the Crimea, which, wait a minute. It's totally wrong to have military intervention. What about Kuwait and Iraq and Afghanistan? It's just they don't make the connect. It's just so strange. So to become an apologist for Western culture is a very dangerous thing to do. It has no basis. It's asatyam apratishtante jagadaha. Has no basis. It has no fixed basis. Western culture can just change. It has markedly changed, even in the last generation. It's always changed. That by its very nature, it's subject to change because it's based on human ideas. And it always will go on changing. So how can you say Western culture? Is that the maybe that's the reason that Western people think that Western culture is the highest, because it has no fixed basis. But that's exactly the reason why religionists decry it. And of course, the Christian fundamentalists, they don't, well, because their own scriptures and their interpretations of scriptures are so faulty, it practically bolsters the position of people who oppose theism. Practically, much of what goes on in the name of Christianity in America today is good fuel for atheism. But the principle that knowledge, ultimate knowledge, including knowledge of how to live in this world, comes from a higher source, which is given to us, and that's called scripture. That is a central principle of theism, and you can't run theism on what is basically an atheistic template. And incidentally, that theistic template, which we receive from the Vedas, includes directions for how to live our life in all aspects. As I said yesterday, even down to when you build a house, where should the main entrance be? Where should the kitchen be? Where in the kitchen should the stove be? Down to all details. So, another major mistake, which I believe, well, it's well known that the chief ideologue, or maybe the only ideologue of Krishna West, he doesn't like Indian culture. And there's a major mistake to equate the present highly confused India of today with Vedic culture, as it's meant to be. So that's another way. But at the same time, to throw out all the excellent points of Indian culture, because there are serious problems with India today, it's philosophically speaking, it's an extremely childish and a mistake to make. Anyway, there are a few points. I could probably go on talking about this for hours, but I won't just now, unless there are any questions. What is the time? Oh, right, we have to get on with the yajna, the initiation and everything. Could you please come here and read it in the mic? I'd like to get this recorded. Can you tell us the source of this? It's from a newspaper article. Oh, okay.
That according to the center of responsive politics, the total of
you have to hear on and then we'll understand what it is. I mean, what does it mean, responsive politics?
That's a group of people who like to monitor politics because they don't trust everything that goes on in the world of politics.
Okay.
So according to that center, the total amount of money spent by the Obama campaign in 2008 came in at $730 million.
That's
$730 million.
That's peanuts.
far outspending Republican, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, compared like to military spending, it's peanuts.
Yeah, so we can then think, how much does he have to make if he spends for one campaign $730 million?
Yeah. I remember after the Falkland Islands War, which probably most of you... Have anyone heard about that? The Falkland Islands War? The older people would have. That was in the 1980s. It was a little military skirmish. It took about 2 weeks for the Brits to defeat the Argentinians. One reason was because I was just talking about this Pinochet who kept the Argentinians busy on the border. He deliberately did that to support, and so the Argentinians couldn't put their full force into the Falklands. So he was doing that to help the Brits, because the Brits, Americans, they're all part of the same team. They'd put him in and were keeping him in. Anyway, after it was all over and everyone said, "Jai, at last we won something. We lose all the football games, we lose all the cricket games, but at least we won a war against Argentina, some little country down there." So after some time, people said, "Well, how much did it cost?" And then it came out, you know, so many billions of pounds. And one naval chief, it was largely a naval operation, said, "Well, that's nothing. We spend that kind of money routinely in naval exercises anyway." So Hare Krishna. Yeah, they spent $730 million for politicians. It's just grist for the mill. Go and look at those people on the beach who are living in their cars. Tell them that he spent $730 million so he could come in and help people like you who are living on the beach. Well, I don't think they talk about, do they? Maybe they talk about helping the people living, no place to live. What a disgrace for a country like America, which has so much power, so much money, and they have thousands of people with no homes. What a disgrace. What a disgrace. The people, they go and risk their life for military campaigns, and then they're just left to fend for themselves. What a disgrace for this country. This National Health Service was started in Britain and was later dismantled to a large extent by the Thatcher government. Because the idea was that, well, we just spend so much money fighting a war, we're able to manage such expenditure, we could maybe do something for our own people and then they started the National Health Service. So there's something good they did. Orlando has more beggars than any other city than any city in India. Orlando has more beggars than any major city in India. Is that what you're saying? Hyderabad, you don't see so many beggars. That's true. I never thought of that. In Bombay, at every stoplight, there are beggars. Hyderabad, you don't see them much, do you? Why is that? Because of Telugu culture or what? The beggars in Bombay, they're mostly these tribal people. I don't know where they come from because there are no tribals. Well, in South Gujarat, Northwest Maharashtra, I don't know where they come from. They could come from anywhere in India. In Bengal, there are plenty. China, South India in general, you don't see many beggars. It's more of a North Indian phenomenon. Maybe due to Islamic influence, I don't know. Though most of the beggars are Hindus, not Muslims. We're over time. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Someone can do a sociological investigation of the beggars in India.